We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Freinas at the controls this morning. Earlier this week, authorities in Massachusetts announced that 9 teenagers would face a range of felony charges in connection with the bullying of a classmate. The prosecutor in this case said the harassment of 15-year-old Phoebe Prince had been so relentless she had been driven to suicide. It's something that has received national attention and been reported across the country. Is bullying becoming a more serious problem, or perhaps are we taking it more seriously? On this part of Focus, we'll be talking with one of the country's leading experts on the subject, Dorothy Espelage. She's professor of educational psychology at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. And in her research, she spent a lot of time thinking about, working on, writing about bullying and youth aggression. It's one of her main foci of work. She's done a lot of writing on the subject, and maybe just I'll mention one thing that's recent, which she's the co-author. That's a book entitled Bullying Prevention and Intervention. You can also, I'm sure, find some of her other work in the library or in the bookstore. We'll be talking this morning and try to cover some of the basics on this issue. And questions, of course, from people who are listening, questions and comments are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. You may also send along your comments by email, and that address is will-talk@illinois.edu. So that way is open, but of course, people who are interested in calling in and making their comments, you can do that too. Again, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. And Dorothy Espelage joining us this morning by telephone. Hey, thanks very much for talking with us.
Good morning.
We appreciate it. I'm sure that, as you know, you have done a lot of writing and speaking on this subject, that any time that it's in the news, as it is now, I suppose your phone starts to ring.
Yes, it has been ringing most of the week, for sure. Yeah, it's and unfortunately, it's happening what appears to be more frequently and with more severity.
Well, that I think that's the natural question. It is something that is getting more attention and more is written about it, and I think people are talking about it and recognize that it's a serious issue. So again, though, whenever that happens, you have to ask this question: well, is whatever it is we're talking about, is there more of it, or is it a case where the level of awareness is greater?
I would actually argue from a scientific standpoint that the programs that we have believed to be effective are turning out not to be effective. So we have generations of kids that are going through middle school and high school in which they haven't really been given really efficacious bullying prevention programs. Our programs are not working despite the fact that we have 67 programs, but there have been some recent meta-analysis that come out and said these programs are not working in the United States. They're working beautifully in European countries, but they're not working in the United States. And we have recent research to suggest what those programs are lacking, which we can talk about. So I don't think it's necessarily an increase. I just think that we are, you know, promoting programs that are not working, and that's why we're seeing severity in earlier ages, because the programs aren't working. And then when the kids are not given really good, effective kind of life skills and social skills to manage conflicts, then it escalates to an unfortunate event that we've seen in Massachusetts, which is an extreme case, but certainly last week we've had other cases of suicides in this country. You know, it's getting attention because we're now, they're going to prosecute the actual perpetrators, and it went on for so long with adults seeing it happen, right? Mm-hmm. So every worst nightmare that you can think of played out in this scenario.
Well, there, I can pick up on several things there, but let me pick up on just one of the things that you said. In the coverage of this particular event, one of the things that you do see in the stories is that, as you have said, that adults were aware that this was going on. So you have to ask this question, well, if you knew this was going on and was going on for a long time, why didn't you do something about it?
Yeah, our schools tend to be not proactive in that way. So you can go from faulting the individuals that were standing around in the library when they saw this young lady being harassed, or you can think all the way to the administration that's so concerned about kind of the testing situation that we have and, you know, laying off of teachers that the liability and the concern about, you know, addressing this is just not on their radar, unfortunately. It's not on their radar. And I believe, I'm convinced that there's many really good principals and administrators out there that are just overworked, overwhelmed, and when they lay their head down at night, they hope that this type of incident doesn't happen in their school. That lacks the proactive nature that you have in bullying prevention. And what's intriguing to me, as somebody that's studied this for 15 years, is the surprise of the community of, like, how could this happen? My reaction is it's happening a lot more. It just escalated to the point where she committed suicide and successfully completed suicide. Mm-hmm. But I would suspect, based on my research, that this scenario is playing out in many of our communities in the United States.
How, I think one of, as I think a lot of people have pointed to, one of the problems here being that for a long time, maybe teachers, parents, administrators, adults looked at this kind of conflict between kids and they've said, well, this is something that they have to work out themselves, and we shouldn't be involved, and in fact maybe it would be better if they somehow figured out how to resolve things between themselves. Is that kind of mindset, do you think, still operating?
Clearly it is in some communities, and I've heard that for 15 years. I mean, I've literally heard that over and over again. I believe I hear it less because there's enough families of victims and families of bully victims that are calling attention to it. So I'm hopeful that I'm hearing that less, but certainly in pockets of some communities that is happening. This idea that we somehow let middle school and high school students work things out on their own when they have the medium of the computer, of Facebook, that just escalates this and really makes it much more permanent, I think that's a real disservice to them. They're still... Middle school students are very young adolescents, and in reality, we're raising very young high school students as well. And I think that we should be proactive in that we are adults, we have experience, and we need to make our schools safer. To let them just play that this is why we've lost control of some of our schools and why there's a code of silence and silence among these kids and they don't turn to the administrators and teachers. I'm not sure where we've adopted that. I mean, you can look at the way in which children are viewed historically. And we thought about children as little adults, but that's the reality is we're not raising them in that way, and they're not coming out that way. So I think we need to be consistent that if we're going to handhold them through academic issues, which we do, then I think we need to handhold them a little bit through social skills development. We also have to recognize with NCLB and with the focus on testing and with budget cuts left and right in education, we have seen less and less attention to giving kids social skills, basic life social skills, conflict resolution skills, listening skills, negotiation skills, compromising skills, those social-emotional learning skills that lay the foundation for them to manage these type of conflicts. We haven't given them those tools, and we haven't for a long time. The majority of our social workers or counselors in the schools are not doing one-on-one work or group work around psychosocial issues. They're really preparing for the test, recovering from the test, and then doing the same thing over to make sure our kids are reaching academic standards. I think that's all well and good, but if we're raising generations of kids that do not have the basic skills to be and contribute to a good workforce, then we're going to have major, major problems. Mm.
We have a couple of callers here. Why don't we start in? We'll talk first, I believe, with someone in Urbana on our line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Hi. Yeah. Yes, I completely agree with you that we have neglected the social skills side of education. What I'm concerned about now is actually bullying is happening in grade schools.
Yes.
And quite significantly, some of the things that I have seen and observed myself is the lack of presence of an adult when this happens, and What is worse is that in some cases, at least, teachers tell students to basically shut up and not tattletale when bullying was happening. So instead of being there and taking some action of talking to the children, the one who is worried about it is asked to shut up. And I think that's a trend, or I hope it's not a trend, but those are the incidents that really bother me as a grandfather.
Right, and I would say to that, and on the side of the teachers, that most pre-service teachers at university get very little instruction in the area of bullying, knowledge-based or skills-based. This is unfortunate because the meta-analysis that are saying that those programs are promising and are really good in Europe are changing teachers' competency and efficacy about recognizing and intervening effectively. So until we teach these pre-service teachers or teachers that are right in the trenches right now, they don't have the skills. We haven't given them that kind of work set skills. We have not provided them with that. But yet we have many, many demands on them. So I think, you know, we're currently evaluating a social-emotional learning program in upwards of 36 to 38 middle schools. And the hallmark of that program is to have the teachers implement the program versus a researcher just coming in or an outside person to actually encourage the teachers to say, you know what, you can be effective within the context of the bullying situation. And it makes sense. From a human perspective, if you don't feel comfortable intervening, then you want it to kind of go away. Unfortunately, they're telling the kids that message, and it doesn't go away, right? It's not a normal conflict.
So. I'm sure part of the problem is funding. I'm not denying that.
Yeah.
But I hope our lawmakers are listening that education needs more funding. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. We'll go to another caller, someone in Indiana. This is our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I certainly second that thing about education needs more funding here in Indiana, particularly in Illinois. My God. Mm-hmm. Two questions. You mentioned that things were, I guess, sort of going fine in Europe. And I'm sure you're going to mention what the difference was between the programs or whatever the situation was that allowed the Europeans to pull this off and Americans not to. So I'd like for you to speak to that. And secondly, from my own experience, when I was in grade school, me and another fellow, we used to take care of the playground, so to speak. We took care of little boys who hurt little girls. And we thought growing up that everything was okay. Then I found out about ostracization. There was a girl in our class who was ostracized from the first grade on. I didn't know a lot about that because I didn't play in that group. But nobody had anything to do with her. Never invited to anything. Never. All the way through senior high school to graduation. And, of course, she had a breakdown. She's a lot better now, and I've been talking to her. And it's amazing. She can pick out things. What would happen on a Monday, blah, 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 you know. And she just knew all of these intimidations and things were not exactly what we call physically bullying, but certainly were psychologically. And I wonder if you can speak to that also. Thanks a lot. Another excellent program.
Thank you. Yeah, I think the Europeans have it a little bit easier, right? They're smaller countries. They have a Ministry of Education that says we're going to stamp out the bullying problem. So they have funding, they have support, everybody's on board, and they can mandate a countrywide prevention and intervention program. There's also, in some of these countries where it's more effective, they're much more homogeneous, and they're not necessarily dealing with the complexities of the school districts that we have. What it means is that we really need to do some good studies here to see how do we modify that from district to district. So I do work in Chicago Public Schools, but also do work in downstate Illinois. They're very different types of schools, and so they have different resources coming to the table. So I think there's a lot of complexity. The error that we've made in this country is to assume that we can just translate these programs into our districts without some type of consideration of the multicultural nature of our schools, of the English as second language issues, and the other types of things around special education and those types of things. So that, I mean, I think that these programs have some really promising ingredients, but until we recognize as the U.S. we haven't necessarily figured this out, one size fits all is not going to work, then I think that we'll have some good progress. I would like to add also that we're working very closely with Congress and the Senate around NCLB reappropriation and making sure that we have some language in there about social-emotional learning and teacher training and quality around safety issues. So we're doing what we can to add to that. I think the caller is perfectly right about that there's some kids that just go unnoticed that are victims, and they're almost silent victims because they don't necessarily make a fuss, and they're quiet, and they keep them to themselves. But in some ways, that it's much more torturous, and it goes on for a really long time. We don't do a good job, for the most part, as humans, to make sure everyone's included once we're adults. I think there's that rare individual that understands, you know, ostracism and understands isolation. And I've had some middle school students where we've interviewed them, and that's been their role, the bystander or the liaison that can negotiate between different networks and for some reason can feel that empathy toward that ostracized victim. But for the most part, that's not the general climate. And once you get to high school, I mean, everybody's kind of in their group and in their clique, and there's a level of apathy both on the part of the students and the teachers, that level of cohesiveness is just not there, which then speaks to that we really need to be able to foster the importance of belonging, not necessarily everybody liking each other, but foster that belonging early on, preschool playgroups, right? Let's think seriously about how adults engage in the play dates and what kind of messages we're sending to kids when a mom makes a decision not to invite another mom, therefore not inviting their child. So I think that early on we're promoting this exclusion and segregation, which I don't think is going to go away necessarily given kind of our socioeconomic stratus, you know, division in this country. But I think that we need to recognize that there are silent victims that are not necessarily outwardly going to attempt suicide, but definitely do have suicidal ideation. Mm-hmm.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dorothy Espelage. She's a professor of educational psychology at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. And this subject we're talking about here this morning, bullying and youth aggression, is a major focus of her writing and research. And also she's done a lot of speaking about this program. She's traveled around speaking with groups. She's done a lot of media interviews, and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And we will also be happy to take emails at will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to go back to something you said really when we were just starting out about the fact that the programs we thought were effective aren't. And I think it's true. If you go around and travel to schools and you ask them, there'll be a lot of places where they'll say we have anti-bullying programs. And in fact, there are 41 states that have anti-bullying laws, but somehow these things are just not working. What's wrong with the programs that we have that we thought, and maybe in a lot of places they think, are working?
Right. So I'll start first with those 41 states. Many of them are unfunded legislation, so that just kind of sits there, right? So there's no money backing it, and there's no grants for the schools to write to actually underwrite their bullying efforts. It's not going to go anywhere. And that's certainly like Florida's got a really funded, nice funding bullying legislation. So where there's some funding behind it, we see a little bit more movement. However, what these programs lack, and, you know, these are my hypothesis based on my research of what's showing that correlates very highly with bullying. Mm-hmm. So, for example, many of these programs, and there's about 67 of those programs when we last checked last week, they pop up all over the place. But for the most part, none of these programs really address some of those key predictors of bullying. And one of those includes family violence or sibling aggression. Now, I don't necessarily believe that schools are going to be able to tackle family violence or sibling aggression, but these programs need to recognize that we somehow have to give kids some type of experiences that counter the fact that they are being victimized and aggressed upon by their siblings or they're witnessing violence in the home. And so if that, if in fact, is a huge predictor of middle school bullying perpetration and we're not addressing that in our programs, then we're not going to move the needle. We're not going to be as effective. Number two, another really strong predictor of bullying is the peer group phenomenon, in that it is seen to be cool to be a bully. And I've said this on this program before, we consistently find support for this birds of a feather flock together. There's a socialization process. We've written about, you know, if you join a bully group, if that's what they do in sixth grade, you will look much more like them by the end of sixth grade and into seventh grade. We've just now found that that homophily hypothesis of birds of a feather flock together actually holds for sexual harassment and homophobic types of bullying, which is really rampant in our middle schools. So if the programs are not targeting the peer norms and shifting the peer norms from kind of promoting bullying to more pro-social behaviors, we're not having any impact. None of these programs, with the exception of one, are trying to attempt to target the peer norms. And that hasn't necessarily, that second step from the Committee for Children middle school program, that hasn't been rigorously evaluated. So here we have family violence and violence, witnessing kind of violence in the home, being a victim of a sibling aggressor, and then not addressing the peer norms. You're looking at a good 30 to 40% of the variance that is, you know, kind of attributed to these variables that are not being addressed in the prevention program.
Hmm.
I would also add to that that we have done no modifications, right? The big program comes out of Norway that we're endorsing and our federal government endorses. There's been no modification to the very different racial and socioeconomic types of situations that we have in our schools and the school resources. Now, what I suspect that there are some programs out there that are working and that are focused on just did it work and did it not work is really an immature research question, that in fact we need to go back to good prevention science and say, who does this program work for, under what conditions, at what level does a school need to be ready for implementation? Because there's great variability in the schools in which some schools have, and I can give them a program and they can be off and running with it. Other schools, they don't have the backing of the administration. They don't necessarily have the parental involvement to kind of back something up that's going to be sustainable. So, you know, we have to let good prevention science, not a state mandate, drive the development of these programs and the evaluation of these programs. Because we know that if a program is implemented at a high, high level with enthusiasm, with the teachers, which increases sustainability, not just the social worker, that in fact we have a direction of promise within prevention. But until we really bring prevention science back to bullying prevention, which has mostly been marketed by supposed, in quotes, experts that are not really looking seriously about how bullying is changing. The caller earlier said that it's happening in elementary school, and certainly it's happening in preschool playgroups. And we have to recognize that the media and the social network sites is changing all of this tremendously. Most of these programs that we're talking about have been developed in the 80s and the 90s. How applicable do you think a middle school program that's developed in the 80s and 90s is to today, 2010, with what adolescents deal with? Mm. Not very.
Our guest, let me just introduce once again for people who might have just tuned in. We're talking with Dorothy Espalach. She is a professor of educational psychology here at the University of Illinois. She has done a lot of writing and research and speaking on this subject, that is bullying and youth aggression. It's a major focus of research work that she does. She's done scholarly writing. She's also been interviewed widely in popular media, and we're pleased you could be spending some time with us here on the program to talk about the issue. We have one caller here ready to go. I have an email that we'll get to. People who are listening are certainly invited to share their thoughts. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455 and email will-talk@illinois.edu. And we'll talk next with someone in Urbana on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. I'm calling because I was a teacher for 34 years in this area, and one of the things that I worked very strongly for was having alternative schools that were based on personal choice. And what we did was we actually surveyed students in our schools at the high school level on why they weren't coming to school or why they were getting into trouble in school, why they were bullying, all of this kind of thing, and determined that what we needed to do is make a program based on personal and social responsibility. We did that. We actually had students in our school, both in Rantoul, in Mahomet, and in Clinton, who actually were bullies at some point or were being bullied at some point. That was not a qualification you had to have, but it certainly was kids who weren't doing well in traditional school. And we made it a requirement for graduation that each student had to take a course we were teaching in personal and social responsibility. At first, I think everyone thought it wasn't going to work at all. It takes one semester to teach this class. But what happened was this unbelievable thing. It became like a large family of sophomores, juniors, and seniors who were all very different from each other, based on making choices that were good choices for them and getting consequences for not making those choices, which may mean that they are no longer eligible to be in the school. Doesn't mean they can't go to school. Just means that they'd have to return to traditional high school. Once the kids got into the program, I can guarantee you that after taking personal and social responsibility, their lives changed. And a lot of it was because the teachers involved, and there were only four of us, but the teachers involved lived what they taught their kids, and they saw it on a daily basis. And it was the most rewarding thing that I think I ever did in teaching. There is a course called Personal and Social Responsibility by Connie Dombrowski, and I was interested in knowing whether or not your guest has heard of that or seen it implemented.
Yes, I have heard of personal and social responsibility types of coursework, and certainly when I hear you talk, the constructs that come to mind include kind of these personal goals and linking personal goals to responsible behavior, ownership, empathy, making good choices. But also what I heard was a good, and I might be extrapolating from this, but a nice relationship and one of respect between the teachers and the students, right?
Yes.
You're right. I mean, that was the key ingredient there. And I think what we're lacking in our prevention programs is exactly what you're talking about. Most of these programs, they talk to kids about, this is what bullying is. Let's come up with a definition. Let's see if we can identify it. And how are you going to help a victim? Can you intervene? But there's a disconnect from me owning something, of me, you know, really making a decision about how it is that I'm going to live my life. And in some ways, when I talk about the lack of parental involvement, and this is across socioeconomic statuses, that in fact, when there's a lack of involvement in the training around the personal and social responsibility of individuals, this is why we see these things play out in our schools. I think that you're talking about a real shift in the way in which we think about raising children and having them own their own sense of personal and social responsibility. And the one program that we're implementing now, Second Step, I thought exactly what you were talking about, because the teachers implement this. The teachers actually learn social-emotional skills that they don't necessarily have. Right, so, and it becomes part of the milieu of the school where it's modeled. So it's not only the kids that are learning how to listen and compromise and negotiate and manage their time and stress, cope with stress, but the teachers are saying out loud all of these same things. And so it becomes part of the fabric of the school. It's not just this is bullying and we shouldn't do it, but in fact we're going to learn those types of, you know, skills, and it's an attitude shift.
Actually, it's teaching strategies as well.
Yeah.
It's actually teaching kids, what is an appropriate risk to take, and what are three questions you can ask yourself about whether or not it's appropriate. Just lots of things that are strategies, because kids and adults sometimes don't have those strategies. And once they're introduced and modeled, just as you said, they take ownership of those things. And if you can have someone in your school of 45 kids, one who is flamboyantly gay and another who is someone who is a classic, what we would think of as a classic bully, for them to coexist in that one environment with that kind of thing going on, is a very difficult thing to do if you don't have a strategy to do it and have it modeled for you. So, you know, I know it can be done. And if we actually go to personal and social responsibility as a requirement for graduation, you know, we may graduate people who are more compassionate toward other people.
Right. I agree. Wow. And I think what's important there and what I hear you saying is I think there has to be a recognition that we have adults that don't necessarily have these skills. I mean, there's a real resistance to admit that the parents and the teachers that are teaching our children are lacking some of these basic social-emotional learning skills and personal responsibility. And I oftentimes, you know, people feel very uncomfortable about that, but I think that, you know, it's a historical shift for whatever reason, you know, with the recession and the focus on dual careers, that something's gotten lost in the process, and we have generations of adults that are lacking these skills. And how do we think they're going to transmit these skills to their children when they lack them?
That's true. Right. Well, thank you.
Thank you for the call. We have some others coming in. I have an email here, and I want to read some of it and get your reaction. We have someone who's been listening to the conversation who said they really felt that there were not many caring principals, to use their words, who were willing to tackle the problem because of the parents of the bullying kids. Here's what the person says. Principals take the approach that kids from influential families and or jocks are untouchable, and therefore the problem won't even be properly addressed. The listener says, I fault the teaching programs particularly because that's where principals are given their basic attitude, which right now is to avoid conflict with parents at all costs, even if it hurts some of the students.
Okay, my first reaction is some way is to agree that most of, based on my experience of 15 years, the access I get to schools are not the affluent schools. Okay, so from the get-go, most of our research are from those schools in which we have really caring kind of principals and we have lower parental involvement. And they're not running us out of the schools. I have, as a researcher, have been run out by those affluent families because somehow I have an agenda or somehow I'm going to uncover, you know, the truths about their families or what it is that their children are doing. So I agree with that statement. And for the most part, we are doing research and conducting this research in non-affluent areas. I think there is tremendous pressure on teachers and administrators to go along with some of these parents. We have to recognize the teaching profession is one of the top five hazardous occupations in this country for physical threats of being physically harmed, but also of intimidation and bullying. And I will tell you, because I spend a lot of time shaking hands with principals in the state of Illinois, that there's great variability. So for this study where we needed 38 middle schools, I probably talked to 100 principals, some that didn't want to touch it for whatever reason, of their contingencies of their parents, some that just couldn't be creative in their problem-solving to think about how it is that we could spend 50 minutes a week talking to kids about their social-emotional training. So it certainly is, it's true, but the problems can be, and the blame could be spread out from pre-service kind of institutions that really have pressure from the state to cover a certain curriculum all the way to the structure right now that's getting rid of our non-tenured teachers who are some of the strongest teachers and most motivated. You know, we're keeping tenured teachers that may necessarily not be as engaged in the process, all the way to administrators that for whatever reason, fear of, you know, upsetting the popular parents, just do not want to take that risk. I'll tell you what, though, when you run across a principal or a superintendent that's willing to put their career on the line to make their school safer, then that's what keeps you going in the day. And there's plenty of them in this state that said, you know what, it may not be popular, but we're going to do this, and we're going to do it right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and just one other point, and I don't know if this is taking the discussion to a level that's too big, but I do go back to one of the things you said about how one of the key predictors of bullying was, do you come out of a family where there's family violence, and is there violence involving siblings? I think some people would want to ask some sort of larger question about how it is in our society we think about violence, and that we're far too tolerant of violence visited by the strong against the weak.
Right. I mean, mean, I think we need to recognize that that's an important variable. What it means is that the schools, and this kind of goes to a larger issue, most of our programs are what we call primary prevention. So they're whole school-wide primary preventions. We have very few programs or what we call secondary, tertiary, where we pull out those kids that are at risk, where we do a family checkup and we find out, okay, there's circumstances within this family that places this child at risk, whether it's exposure to violence, whether it's neighborhood violence, and then we work individually with those kids. So that's part of the problem, too, is that, you know, we're not going to have schools tackle family violence, but we should really, as a government, be invested in those kids that are showing some signs of being at risk for not graduating from high school or becoming involved in criminal activity, that we do something beyond just a primary prevention program. And that's, you know, that takes more money, that takes more resources, but in the end, if we can steer those kids, much like the caller before last talked about those kids that were in alternative settings, if you can stir that put them into a better position to graduate high school, to be gainfully employed, this is what we need to be attending to. So there's lots of layers in which, you know, we need to not just look at the schools, but look at the collaborations between schools and our communities and really getting parents to understand that it is not a fault of theirs if they have a child that is a ringleader bully. They're out there, and they come from, in addition to this, relatively okay families. You know, yes, there may be some violence. Yes, there may be a lack of kind of psycho-emotional training, but we have to recognize and not be shocked when this happens in Massachusetts. How many emails and phone calls I've got are just like, how could this happen? And I'm thinking to myself, what do you mean? It will continue to happen until we recognize that we're not doing what we need to be doing as a society to really face up to, we have kids that have the capacity to humiliate other kids on an ongoing basis. This isn't an isolated event. This was planned out, and there were groups of kids that were engaging in this type of behavior, which we show there's a peer process. This isn't a thug bully that's planning this. This is the support of a lot of peers.
Yeah. Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus on 580, Dorothy Espelon. She's professor of educational psychology here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. She's done a lot of writing and research on bullying and youth aggression, and that's what we're talking about here this morning. Questions welcome. We do have several. We'll try to get everybody in the time that remains, about 10 minutes left. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Next, we'll talk with someone in Edgewood on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Do bullies know they are bullies? Earlier, we had a caller who called in and talked about he had a group together that enforced on the playground. Well, someone like me, who I feel I've never bullied anybody, to me, that would be a group of bullies. Do bullies know they are bullies? That's my question.
That's a very interesting question. Well, because we've adopted everything from the European model, most researchers in this country give kids a definition of bullying, and then they have to decide whether or not they're a bully. So there's an extreme subjective nature. I ask kids if they engage in certain behaviors. So do they exclude? Do they rumor spread? Do they call names? Do they isolate? Do they do these things in such a high frequency that we could say, like, okay, this is not normative? Do they have an audience? Do they have their entourage? Do they have supporters? Do they have instigators? So, I mean, it's a very wonderful question because some of our real ringleader bullies, if you give them a definition of bullying, they'll say, well, I'm not doing that. I don't, you know. So it's a good measurement question, and there's great heterogeneity and the willingness. Some bullies wear it as a badge, and they're quite proud that they are kind of the bully, and that tends to be in the elementary school. They're less likely to report it in middle school and high school because the kids actually know now that there's legislation and that they might get in trouble for it. But for the most part, they just say, hey, we're having fun. They don't really care about the victim's feelings. And so as opposed to trying to say, do you really know that you're a bully, we look at kind of the implications of their behaviors within the context of schools. And if we have kids that aren't coming to school because they fear a particular group and a ringleader, or if they feel that they're depressed or anxious around the name-calling and the relentless kind of being subjected to this behavior, then we assume that there's a bullying situation. I love talking about what bullying is and the definition and when does it cross from kind of normative stuff to bullying. So I appreciate the question.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to make this point. I think maybe some people, when they think of bullying, they think of acts of physical aggression. And while that it is bullying, that also you have to include psychological, emotional kinds of acts of aggression as well.
Most definitely. And so we've seen in this case in Massachusetts where it just included everything you could possibly put under a definition of bullying.
Yeah.
But for the most part, in the middle school, it tends to be much more subtle, and bullies can turn it on and off, and that's why sometimes teachers don't see it. And, there's the exclusion and the name-calling and all kinds of things. We still have kids writing things on bathroom walls. And the walls now have become Facebook, walls, but... Mm-hmm. So there's a great variability in how it plays out. And it varies depending on schools. I'm in some schools where the cyberbullying is really, really a problem. And then in other schools, it's less of that. It's homophobic kind of bullying. So it varies on the context.
All right. Next, we'll talk with someone in Champaign, line 3. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. I think we're in I look around at our society and just reading the paper and listening to what people are saying. The adults have brought bullying out into the open so badly this, just recently. I see a lot of bullying in our legislature, in our discourse on TV and how people talk to each other. Are we modeling for a real rash of additional bullying in the future?
Yeah, I'm not sure whether or not this political kind of bullying that we see is new. Or if the media is just covering it more. I mean, even when we were on this call, there was a discussion of, 30 notes sent to our politicians threatening that they should be removed. So, I think that, I don't know. I certainly agree with the caller and I don't know if it's because I'm aging and I don't see necessarily those around me paying attention to my recommendations and my research, but I also do not have a very good feeling about where we're going. And the different levels at which kids can be exposed to exclusion and just nasty behavior. I think of this story. There was a young boy, it might have been in the Northeast too, that created this no cussing club, and he just wanted people to kind of sign on and, we're not going to cuss. We're going to use respectful language. And the backlash from his no cussing club, and he received some death threats, he's like 12 years old on the web. And I had a reviewer say, what do you think of this? And I said, unfortunately, that's American society. There's just pockets of adults and children that somehow feel that it's okay in a public forum to do these types of things. And I'm open to freedom of discussion and, your opinion. But at some level, when do we pay attention to what we are, how we're socializing our children? And I think it comes from media and it comes from television. And we have to look at some of the children's programming to pick on Nickelodeon. There's a number of shows in which, if you watch, there's repeated demonstrations of bullying, exclusion, and just general humiliation. So, and some of my colleagues who take a stronger stance would say that it's a training ground, if you will. Our society is a training ground for these bullies.
And we're also seeing it in I hate to say this, but I heard it from a child in seventh grade who said it was okay to pick on the kid that looked like a fag because my church says that he's a sin and therefore I can, I'm obligated. I was absolutely shocked that this came out of a, quote, religious teaching.
Right. Yeah, and we have to recognize, I am a big proponent that there's lots of things that need to change in our society and this homophobic nature that we have. In my research, about 30 to 50% of the content of bullying is around sexual orientation, assumed or presumed, right? So we used to always think when they say fag and this type of thing, that they don't really know what that is. Yes, they know exactly what it is, and it serves a purpose.
Right.
And garden variety bullying becomes homophobic bullying, which then leads to boys then sexually harassing girls because that's the best way to demonstrate masculinity. So I think that, there's certainly these underwritings, and there are going to be religious groups that feel that homosexuality is not natural, Those groups that take it to putting their kids in the middle school and promoting this type of behavior, unfortunately, that attitude will fit very well from our middle schools right now because we're not paying any attention to sexual orientation and the fact that kids are coming out earlier and they're coming out to teachers, and it could be the most disastrous thing they've ever done. And so when we look at the bullying prevention programs, too, this is another area, David, that we have not talked about.
Mm-hmm.
There are 2 to 3 programs that talk about bullying directed at sexual orientation issues. That's appalling to me when, in fact, being non-heterosexual is all you are opening yourself up to a tremendous amount of victimization in the majority of our schools. And even those schools that have gay and straight alliances, the presence of that actually could even be more disastrous because the adults may not support that. So we have a tremendous amount of work to do in the area of making our schools safer for those kids that are either sexually questioning or they're LGBT. So, I mean, it's a good comment, but what do you do? I know you sometimes get kind of frustrated.
Yeah.
We need to just kind of keep plugging along and see how we can get the mindset to change. And it does. It changes. It shifts as the wind blows almost sometimes. So.
Maybe about 5 minutes here. I want to thank the last caller. Get to at least one more. We'll go to Savoy, line 2. Hello. I guess that person changed their mind. Okay. How about we go to caller
Hello?
Here? Yes, go ahead. We have a caller here. Go ahead. Yes.
Yes, this is Savoy.
Oh, I'm sorry. I yes, please go ahead.
All right. The woman that just spoke covered a lot of things I was going to mention, actually. But one of the things I was wondering about, 2 points. First of all, I know someone who's in their 8th decade now, and I saw this in another parent when I was younger. And he would send his son out to actually fight another child instead of trying to resolve it in a reasonable way. And this was when these kids were like only 5 years old and out in the backyard. So that's one problem. I do think some parents encourage it. Maybe they think if they don't teach their child to be the aggressor that they will be the victim of an aggressor. I don't know. My neighbor, who's in his 8th decade, said when he was a boy and started in grade school, his father told him to pick out the smallest kid in the playground and beat him up. So he did. So there's that, and I don't know if he had violence in his home or not, but I've seen homes where there was violence, and kids come out of that being more sensitive rather than, you know, bullies. So I don't know if that's it. I think TV, the media does, movies do play a big thing. They make bullying look like macho, and, you know, it makes you important. The other thing, and my main question is, in the last decade, it seems like this has really increased, because when I was growing up, and we moved around because my dad was military, and I was in a lot of different schools, and I saw very, very little of it. I can remember one incident, which was against my sister and I, and a girl used to throw rocks at us when we get off the school bus and give me a hard time on the playground. But that's the only time I ever really remember seeing it, and it seems it's become so prevalent, and I'm wondering what the social environment is of our country in general, if it is the media or what, that's encouraging this. And I'll just hang up and listen, and thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you. I would echo the point. When we've researched kids over the last probably 5 years, we have kids, higher rates of kids indicating that their parents are saying hit back. And so there is a change in climate shift in parents encouraging their kids to fight back if they're threatened. I'm not sure about, you know, the parents actually just sending them to school and saying, pick out that young child. But we certainly, when we ask kids, they're being told to defend themselves. And so there's a shift in that direction. What was the second part of that, David?
Just maybe overall the observation, you know, what's going on here, that there seems to be so much more of it than there used to be. That at least in the experience of the caller, she was thinking about maybe when she was a girl, that aside from one kind of incident she talked about, she sort of felt, and having been in a number of schools because her family moved around, that it was just something that she just didn't see that much.
Right. Yeah. And I'm also a military child too, and it's a different word, different lot. So, what do I make of the rise? I think society has changed generally. I think that kids are growing up quicker cognitively, not necessarily socially, so there's a gap there. We're seeing the suicides because of the inability of these kids to manage the depression, anxiety, and the hopelessness, and for whatever reason, not feeling like they can reach out and get help. I've alluded to the fact that we're not attending to psychosocial skills within the kids because of the sacrifice that we've made for NCLB and increasing our academic standards, which I'm behind, but I think we also need to recognize that there's a social development. So one of my major theories is that somehow we just have generations of kids that don't have the coping resources to deal with this. I think there's a lot of bullying that happens out there that we do not hear about. We hear about the suicides. We hear about the school shootings. And the reality is there's lots of kids that are suffering in silence. How do we get them to come out and talk about these incidents prior to them killing themselves is much really important. Now, our recent suicides last year were young elementary school kids that hung themselves. So that shift we understood because they don't necessarily have the resources to get a gun and go in and retaliate. And that's not where they're at cognitively either. The recent Massachusetts, I mean, she was just alone in some ways. And, what blocked her from talking to others, I don't know. And it's a special case. But I would argue that I don't know if it's increased. I mean, we don't have those kind of epidemiological studies, which we say every time I'm on the show. We don't know that. We certainly do know that kids are, taking upon themselves to show very loudly to society that they're not feeling safe in these schools. And when these incidents happen and the media go in and they actually talk to middle school and high school students, there's an echoing of what these kids feel, that they almost want to kind of stay to themselves, watch what they say, because they don't want to be the girl that was just beaten into a coma in Florida because she sent an inappropriate text. So I think there's an intersection between developmental psychology's changing, the socialization of kids are changing, they're exposed to a big, wider world, but yet we're not keeping the social development up with that cognitive development. And then you have these kind of immature sets of kids in which parents standing back going, I'm doing the best I can, and teachers and administrators are saying, I don't know if I have 50 minutes a day to talk to kids about social-emotional learning. I think all of that is what's contributing to what we're seeing now.
Yeah. Well, we're at the point where we're going to have to finish up. And again, I want to say to our guest, Dorothy Espelage, she's professor of educational psychology, University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. Thanks once again for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
Thank you very much, David.
WILO programs are made possible by Women's Health Practice and Dr. Suzanne Troopin, offering obstetrics, gynecology, and fertility services on Neal in Champaign. Women's Health Practice is a Health Alliance medical plan provider and is accepting new patients. More information is available at womenshealthpractice.com. Support for WILO also comes from the College Illinois 529 prepaid tuition program, the tax advantage plan that shields families from tuition inflation by allowing them to lock in prices now at colleges. More information can be found at 529prepaidtuition.org. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni Alice and Robert Campbell. And that's pretty much it for us here on Focus. But, of course, we want you to stick around. There'll be more coming up as part of the afternoon magazine. News, features, other things. The host for that show, Celeste Quinn.